Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is David Liebrich, Commissioner of the Financial Management Service within the U.S. Department of the Treasury. So, Dave, this year, I believe, marks the 15th anniversary of Congress's enactment of the Debt Collection Improvement Act of 1996, which fundamentally changed the way the federal government collects its delinquent debts. First, could you tell us a little bit more about the law? And more importantly, what are the benefits realized from centralizing debt collection?
You know, I tie back a little bit. You asked a question about what else government can do overall to improve financial management, and debt collection is a really good, another good answer to that item to discuss. Is the law has been a tremendous success since it was passed in 1996, and we got off to kind of a slow start. And part of it was, I think, that there was some ambivalence about agencies either understanding what we could or couldn't do as a centralized service and with respect to debt collection, and then becoming comfortable with it. There's two parts of debt collection. The first part is really what I would call is our passive process, which is the offset. That is, FMS makes payments, and we match that payment file against a debt file. And if there's a match, we'll offset the payment to satisfy a debt owed by a federal agency. The second part of debt collection is a more active process, which is you're actually going out, which we call cross-servicing. And that's actually where you're actually trying to go out and collect from a person. So the offset process is somewhat anonymous, although we do outreach and we do let people know what we're doing. The cross-servicing section is much more, you're doing more retail. You're actually going out and trying to collect money from folks. The Debt Collection Improvement Act gives us a variety of tools to do that in a more centralized way. And I would just say, as we're looking forward in the next several years, there's this ample opportunity for a lot more success in both those areas with respect to working the delinquent debt portfolio. We, of course, are always very much concerned about privacy and treating debtors respectfully. And we have a whole set of rules and processes around how we treat debtors. But also, I think that the underlying premise is that if you owe money to the federal government, there's a strong obligation to repay that money, and we should collect that money owed to the taxpayer. So for us, it's been close to $50 billion has been collected since the act, and close to half of that's been for delinquent child support. So when I mentioned earlier, you know, this is something that our employees feel very good about. You know, we're doing something very useful and meaningful, not only just because we're collecting taxpayer money that's owed to the taxpayers, but also because we're helping families in the process.
Actually, I'd like for you to drill down a little bit more, too, in the type of debt that's being collected. You mentioned child support and the two programs, the offset Treasury offset program and the other program that you're alluding to earlier. But more importantly, what is the cost to collect ratio? How much does it cost to collect the dollars that you're collecting?
We're a pretty good deal. Okay. You know, for every dollar that we spend on collection, we recover about $52. Okay. So that's a very, very high ratio in this area. I think that, student loans, small business loans, taxes are all part of the things that we're involved with. And some of the new areas that I think that we're really moving toward is more analytical assessment of the portfolio. You know, as it relates right now, most debts are kind of equal. We don't really look at one debt differently than another, but we actually know that some debts are more collectible than others. And I think the real direction that we'll be going in the future is really trying to improve our analytical capabilities around the portfolio so that when we see a type of debt or debts that are coming in and we think has a higher likelihood chance for success in collections, that we work that debt before we work other debts.
That's an interesting segue because I wanted to talk about what you're doing to expand and build upon your debt collection foundation. What are you doing to put in place a robust, expanded infrastructure so you could able to have a little more flexibility in your system?
We've identified the strategies that we're pursuing in the debt collection area, and one of those is strengthening Treasury's debt collection authorities. And there are things like, in fact, there was a hearing recently about being able to collect debt owed by contractors to the federal government. And we have a piece of legislation forward which said that rather than only collecting 15% of each payment, we could collect a full 100% of the payment against that. And the same thing in the Medicare program where we would be able to capture more, recover more of the funds for each government payment than we presently are. We're also looking at expanded use of administrative wage garnishment, which allows you to take a percentage of someone's paycheck in order to actually satisfy the debt. We're also looking at whether there's value in referring debts to Treasury earlier. Right now, the law says that debts get referred at 180 days. And there's probably good evidence that says if they were referred earlier, there may be a higher likelihood of a chance for success in collections. So that's to strengthen the authorities is one. The second is increase our call center capacity. A third is to implement state-of-the-art debt collection tools, optimize our processes and smarter processes. And a fifth strategy is doing better outreach with the other agencies. So we're working more closely with them on collection strategies, increasing our analytical capabilities, and then improving our overall operations. But the analytical one is, I think, the area that would potentially have its most promise. When a file comes in, sometimes the name doesn't exactly match the address, the payment file versus the debt file. And we're doing a better job now of using automated tools to see whether if someone is John L. Smith at 123 Main Street and the payment file says John M. Smith at 123 Main Street, probably it's the same John Smith. Our present process tends to kick that file out. And so we've been using some more analytical tools, and in fact, even using maiden names. We've been able to sort of say, look, this partial match actually really is a match, and so let's collect on it. And this past year, you know, estimates of $50 million more in collections simply by doing that. And there's lots of opportunities within us to look at that portfolio and understand better about collectability and using more analytical tools and business intelligence tools to do that.
Well, Dave, are there other areas within FMS where you could leverage some of the analytic capability, analytic tools that you were talking about?
The debt area is the one that's the most natural. But we also know in the payments area and the collections area that we can use these same analytical tools. Now, let me give an example. In the payments area, if we were taking a harder look at whether there was a repeat payment being made to the same address for the same amount, one might cue that up and say, I wonder if that's an improper payment. And so these analytical tools have the ability to sort of pull that out and highlight it and say, well, maybe we should take a closer look at that, whether that's the right payment. In the collections area, if there's unusual activity in collections, some behavior, the analytical tools can help you sort of look at that and say, well, maybe we should flag that. So I think this has a lot of promise in the improper payments area, for example. I think that ultimately how you want to use your technology and your business intelligence tools is to date, we really use our reporting systems to report on how things are and to look backwards. But what you really want to do ultimately is to have that technology allow you and that business intelligence to allow you to be predictive and looking forward. And so if you're going to get the highest value and highest use out of your technology and your business intelligence, you want to use it for forecasting and predictive purposes along the way. And so I think for where FMS sits, we sit on an enormous amount of data. And the ability for us to use that data to do predictive analysis is a really promising area for the organization going forward.
Now, you mentioned earlier about the importance of information technology and technology in general in the execution of your mission. What emerging technologies hold the most promise for improving your bureau's outcomes?
Well, I mentioned our critical success factors is the effective and efficient use of technology as being one of them. And we have a fairly significant effort underway right now, which we're calling the fiscal IT area, where we in the Bureau of Public Debt, a sister bureau, are looking at sharing technology. In fact, the goal for that effort is for the two of us to go from 5 data centers down to 2 data centers, and we're well on our way to doing that. We're additionally looking at some shared governance and looking at whether we have shared services that we have, like email systems and the like. And so it's a change in the model of technology, whereas FMS historically has built systems and operated them, as we're seeing across industry and government, shared services or shared software is a much more prevalent direction that you're not really building and designing as much anymore. And FMS is really going in that direction in terms of its operations. The other area within the payments area, we're always looking at how technology is evolving in that area, whether it be mobile payments. But what we have a very important program with the military, our stored value card program, in which we allow the soldiers to actually have stored value cards for the use of transactions rather than money. And this makes a big difference because it's very expensive to actually transport money. Mm-hmm. You know, it's heavy and you have to, and the like, as well as when it came payday, you saw these big long lines at the Army barracks of people trying to get their money. Whereas with the card, they immediately use the card and able to do transactions, whether it be on a ship or on base. And in some cases, they actually can take the card and use it off base. This has had important applications because sometimes when military operations have occurred, it floods those economies with dollars, and that's not necessarily an objective. You kind of want to let the local economy grow on its own. So the stored value card has helped with that as well. It's been a very successful program, and it's one of those other areas where we as an organization are always very proud to be able to serve the military and help them in their mission and really improve efficiencies along the way.
Dave, I'd like to transition a little bit to the annual financial report of the U.S. government. As the manager of the government's central accounting and financial reporting systems, could you tell us a little bit more about this report, what information goes into it, and what about the whole effort of putting it together?
Every year, the United States government needs to put together a financial report of its activity. That's in the Constitution. We're required to do that, and FMS bears that responsibility. We produce a number of reports. We produce something called the daily Treasury statements, which the market tends to look at and see how outlays and receipts are going along the way. We produce something called the monthly Treasury statement, and that's anytime anyone picks up the paper and says this month's surplus or deficit was that's the report that FMS produces based on the financial data that we have. And then we produce a quarterly report, and then finally we produce the financial report of the United States government, which also has along with it a citizen's guide. And the financial report is a compilation of what all the agencies are doing, and it's a tough process. It needs to be done in a very short window period of time. So, for example, by November 15th of each year, each agency needs to submit their audited financial statement. And then by December 21st, we're going to issue the combined statement for the whole government, and that's a fairly significant undertaking.
I was wondering, public companies are disseminating information, financial information, using additional media besides the financial report. Would you elaborate on any plans in the government to use additional media beyond the print?
We do encourage, we try to produce as few of the paper copies of the financial report as we can. So we really very much try to have people look at that online and at fms.treas.gov. I'll put a little pitch in for that.
Perfect.
And there's also the Citizen's Guide, which is an accompanying statement. And the financial report is an important document, and it has a lot of good information, and the process of producing it is very important. But it's not something that's very user-friendly. And so the Citizen's Guide is a compendium to that, which really allows someone to get a sort of plain English picture of where funds are coming from and how they're being spent, as well as the financial future of the country. You know, I think it's a good document, probably not as well widely read as it should be, given the nature of it. But it's a very honest and objective document as well. So I think it serves a very important purpose.
What are the impediments or actions needed to achieve a clean or qualified opinion on the government-wide financial statement?
Yeah, and that's underlying. We do not get a clean opinion on the financial report for three reasons primarily. The first is that there's an intergovernmental elimination problem. There's a very large number of transactions that occur between agencies that don't reconcile. Mm-hmm. We have a number of efforts underway at FMS to address that. The second area is the actual compilation of the report itself. That is, how do you get audited opinions from so many different agencies and pull them together and in a short period of time and are 100% confident that all the numbers are exactly right? And that's not easy. We have some efforts underway at FMS to address that as well. And the third area is that we do have some agencies, DOD being the primary one, which doesn't get a clean opinion as well. And until that happens, it's difficult to have a clean opinion on the overall report. But with respect to the first two, the intergovernmental is an area that I think has a lot of potential for us to make a significant difference in the coming years. And so we have two major initiatives underway at FMS right now really to get at that. One is establishing the general fund and a general ledger so that transactions have a better mechanism to actually score against one another. And the second is to really look at the rules for intergovernmental. In fact, whether there should be an intergovernmental clearinghouse that makes sure that if a transaction is treated one way at one agency, it's treated the same way at the other agency so that one can see the nature of the transaction. We have been in the last year looking at where there's been large differences, and we're now going to each agency and saying, you know, did you know that you've got an intergovernmental difference, which is over $150 million? You need to figure out why that happened and how you can fix it in future years. So I think this coming year, we're going to see some significant progress in that area. I think that the efforts that we have underway in terms of the TAS-BETSI, the reporting at time of transaction, I think those will make a difference with respect to the reporting. We have another initiative underway, which is to call our first effort to have adjusted trial balance information given more real time to agencies so that when they do their adjusted trial balances quarterly, they can get immediate feedback. And if there are problems with it, they can make adjustments earlier rather than later. And we're hopeful that those, at least those two or three efforts, will make a big difference on the intergovernmental and on the compilation side in terms of really advancing and moving toward a clean opinion.
What does the future hold for Treasury's Financial Management Service? We will ask its commissioner, David Liebrich, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.